I was thinking there might be an old Chinese proverb, the journey of 1,000 claps starts with one. I heard somebody begin over somewhere over here. Is Joni, you're in the room. You were right about the coffee, by the way. Thank you. Thank you so much. There was enough to survive. Thank you. And Amy also, are you in the, oh yeah, Amy came to my rescue this afternoon when there was no coffee and she found some. You know, I don't know if you know, I cannot remember the last time I did any kind of message without coffee. It's been that long. It just seems like a faithful friend. Are you kind of like this? Yeah. I get that. That's so funny. So somebody asked me after my lovely first date experience and second date experience, they asked me about how I proposed to Mindy. Now, this has nothing to do, I guess it's just really nothing to do with the message, but it sort of does in the general flow of our week. So her folks were in Fort Lauderdale, and we drove from Fort Worth to Fort Lauderdale, and I was going to ask her father's hand in marriage, and I was scared to death. I went to his office. He was a pastor. And I sat down, just sort of that shaking inside, you know, and it's, Mr. Russ, I love Mindy, and I want to, is it okay, can I have her hand in marriage? Oh, yeah. Did you bring your golf clubs? Let's go. So I thought, okay, passed one test. So I'm thinking, where's a really cool place I can take her? Didn't know anything about Fort Lauderdale. No internet back then. But somebody said, there's a Polynesian restaurant you should go to. Polynesian restaurant. I'd never been to a Polynesian restaurant. But I thought, well, it sounds romantic. So I took her there to do the proposal at the, and we were having a lovely dinner until the entertainment started. And the entertainment started on the stage was a bunch of young girls in hula skirts doing dancing. And so we quickly wrapped up our dinner, and I found the guy to pay, and we left there with about a half-eaten meal. And I'm thinking, okay, relax. You're not going to propose here. Where can you propose? And I remembered Fort Lauderdale had this really cool 9-story thing down at the beach, and at the top was a rotating restaurant. And I'm thinking, that's my place. So we drive over there, we get on the elevator, we get up there, and to go in there, there was a cover charge. Now, I was just as broke as a convict. And it wasn't that big of a cover charge that I recall, but I was sort of annoyed in addition to the money that they were doing a cover charge just to walk in. And I said to her, let's go down to the beach. We got in the elevator and went back down. This was Plan C. So I'm thinking, oh, propose on the beach there in the Atlantic, right down there on the beach. So we get out and we cross A1A, I think is the highway, and we are marching across the beach in something like gale force wind. And the wind is bringing up the sand, and we are trying to keep the sand out of our eyes, and I almost felt like Lawrence of Arabia making that long trek across the Sahara Desert. And every time I would look at her, talk to her, she would turn her head and her hair would just completely obliterate her face. And it was a longer way to the beach than I thought, and it was getting a little chilly. And so I said, this is good enough. So we stopped and we turned to face each other, and her hair again with the wind just blew right across her face. And I'm thinking, this isn't going to work. So I said, so let's go back to the car. So we went back to the car, and I had a little Chevy Monza, a little bitty compact type car. And it was cold, it was windy, and I couldn't think of any other place to go. So in the bucket seats of a little compact car, I proposed. And I think I may qualify for one of the most underwhelming proposals, although you know Randy Lanthrop's proposal story, right? Have you heard that? Oh, okay, here's a bonus for everybody. And what strikes me is this is going to make me feel better about my proposal. So why not? We may have to add a couple minutes on to our time, David. So Randy, great pastor, great friend of ours from many, many years back at Hope, he was going to CBU back then, or CBC, California, then Riverside. And he wanted to go to seminary, and he was dating Cindy, who was going to be his future wife. But she didn't know about the future wife thing. And he was going to go to Fort Worth, and he said to her at one point, "Well, I'd like you to go with me." And in this quiet, I mean, she had no idea what he meant. He said, well, what do you mean? "Well, I want you to go with me." And she says, "Well, like for what?" And said, "Well, I think we should just kind of go together." And she said, "Are you proposing?" And he said, "Yes." And so that, and it turns out, I just found this out, his father had done the same thing with his wife. I'm suddenly thinking, there are a lot of young men in this group. They're going to feel really good about their proposal someday. So, in starting my senior year at college, I'd been a Christian for all of 8 months. I was thrilled to be a Christian, and I had been dating the girl that helped lead me to Christ. She'd taken me to church with her, really, really neat Christian girl. And we just kind of thought, as we were talking and dating, that someday we were going to get married. We just sort of had that vibe going on. And she was away for the summer. I was away for the summer. On the first night back, we went out on a small little date on campus. And I took her back to her dorm. There was a curfew there. And on the front of the dorm at 11 o'clock at night, she broke up with me, sight unseen. Never saw it coming. And I just welled up with tears. I was in shock. And I said, "Well, is it somebody else?" And she said, no. And I said, "Well, what is it?" And she said, "I can't tell you." And in retrospect, or in the moment, I respected her enough to know that if she saw there were good reasons not to tell me, that was good enough. I trusted her. I trusted her judgment. And so I went with that. And I didn't find out about this until a couple years later, and it's a great story. But that night, I was just completely shell-shocked. And I drove home in the darkness in the rural vicinity of this Waco, Texas, out in the countryside, driving to my apartment, just crying. And the darkness just seemed to be such a great metaphor for this. The darkness of a shattered dream and lost love and what's going to happen. And, you know, as an eight-month-old Christian, this was just stunning, just shocking to me. And when I drove home, I was in search of comfort is what I thought of. But in retrospect, I think I was looking for something more. I think what I was really looking for was hope. And when I think about tonight's message, this is what I want to talk about. When I was first a Christian, I remember reading 1 Corinthians 13, the love chapter, for the first time. Where did you go? Lost Prop Patrol. There's one. There's two. Well, this is annoying. I lost the best prop. Oh, there it is. We're going to call this the Golden Dove. And when I think of this, I think about Noah and the ark on that awful voyage for months and months and months, and finally sent out the raven didn't come back, sent out a dove, the dove didn't come back, sent out a second dove, and it came back with a little olive leaf. And when that happened, he knew there was ground somewhere. And that became, for him, a sign of hope. Now, they weren't on ground yet for quite a while, but the dove was enough to say, we're going to be on land again. So I put my coffee over here. That's a mistake. So that's our prop is the Golden Dove as a picture of the message, Golden Hope. One of the things that happened as a young Christian, I remember being just sort of flummoxed. Oh, I forgot to tell you about 1 Corinthians 13. I got to the end of that, and the last verse of that chapter says, faith, hope, and love abide these three, but the greatest of these is love. And as a fairly young Christian, I thought, faith, okay, I get that. Love, I get that. Hope? You mean you're putting hope up there with faith and love? Well, you know, I don't understand that. I don't get that yet, but maybe someday I will. Well, guess what's happened? Yours truly lives consciously every day with a sense of hope. I am banking my life every day on things I can't see and on what's going to happen on the other side of glory every day. I am not trusting what my eyes tell me about how the ministry's going or about how I'm doing or about my growth. I'm trusting the promises of God and that those promises are true. And when I get to the other side of glory, I'm going to be amazed and I will be the happiest person you know because of what we'll see. This is the quality of hope. Now, this element has been virtually eradicated from our culture. This life is all there is what you hear incessantly on TV and movies. And you will hear people say, as you get older, I feel like life is just passing me by. The dreams that I thought I was going to have fulfilled, they're just not happening. The career move up. The kind of marriage that I end up having and trying to struggle with. The financial that I thought we were going to have, or the ministry I thought was going to have. I meet with a pastor who's been out of the ministry for about 8 years. It's really, really been hard for him. Midlife crisis usually is rooted in dreams that are probably not going to be fulfilled. Or, another way of saying it is, in our parlance, second thing, pleasures didn't work out like I thought they were going to. Much to our shock. We either deny that heaven exists. You go to most funerals and you hear, oh, I'm sure he's in a better place. Which is really another way of saying, I'm glad I'm not in that place. Or we say, may he rest in peace. Meaning, he's slumbering away somewhere, completely unconscious, but at least he's somewhere. I mean, it almost like it just trivializes heaven and eternity. And some of the images in the Bible, our culture takes, and again, trivializes those. When you think of heaven in our culture, what do you usually hear? Cherubs, clouds, harps, angel, pearly gates, streets of gold, Peter at the gate. It's really a place nobody would want to go to. That's what we usually have, and yet the Bible is dramatically different from that. You and I may have 70 years, the Bible tells us. And after that, eternity looms. And if you are a second pleasure person, as you get older, and these dreams aren't falling through the way you think they should, you are going to find welling up within you an irresistible urge to make it happen. And that urge will get stronger and stronger when it doesn't happen. And you will find yourself tempted for third thing pleasures that are the forbidden in hopes of finding that satisfaction that you've not been able to find through second. Now, what's different about the 70-year people? The 70-year people don't have any frame of reference for anything beyond here. This is the big dance for secular people. Whereas for you and I, we know this is just the preparation. This is just us getting ready. This is the warm-up for the big game that's getting ready to happen. This is short, not going to be very long, and then we're on. We need a big picture if we are going to walk with Jesus over the long haul. Big picture. And so what I'd like to do is in our session tonight, is give you some of the big pictures the Scripture gives us that matter to me. Okay? There are other ones you might come up with. Malachi 3:13 is a really good example of why we need the big picture. God says to the people, you have spoken arrogantly against me, says the Lord. Yet you ask, what have we said against you? They have no conscious awareness that they're asking this question. You have said it is futile to serve God. What do we gain by carrying out his requirements and going about like mourners before the Lord Almighty? But now we call the arrogant blessed. Certainly evildoers prosper. And even when they put God to the test, they get away with it. Now, the question they're asking is a similar question any of us might ask when our second thing pleasures aren't working. Is it really worth it to follow God? Is it really worth it? My wife loves Hallmark movies. I can't stand them. And forgive me if you love Hallmark movies. I'm just going to give you my take on it. And I'm not claiming to be right. But it seems so simplistic to me. You have this very handsome guy and this very beautiful girl, and they have some connection going on and chemistry, and there's the possibility of something wonderful happen. And then there's some stupid misunderstanding, some stupid miscommunication, some wrong assumption and conclusion that was made about the other person, and the thing just falls apart, and it looks like it's over. And then near the end of the, finally, in the long trek of the movie, we get to the part where the misunderstanding, the miscommunication is discovered, the wrong conclusion was drawn, and they live happily ever after. I can't stand to watch that because that has no reflection in reality. It's just sort of like, hey, this is the way to make a second pleasure work if you follow what they do. The better metric to follow is Adam and Eve. And we get a piece of this in Genesis 3, but we get some editorial and more theological truths about this through the Bible. And the things that strike me here is that when Adam and Eve sinned, there were several things that were really true about them that we tend to overlook. One was inexcusable self-centeredness by both of them. Inexcusable. Second, a refusal to believe what God had told them. They turned away from this. And third, a stubborn determination to pursue second things by each of them. We can make life work. We really don't need God in a functional sense. Now, those three things are the raw material that God has to deal with each of us. And he's in the process of trying to reformat this sin machine that resides and hums along every day. Now, what did Adam and Eve need? What did God do with that? How's he going to change that? The first thing he did, besides talking to them, he told them what was going to happen. And then the next thing they found out, they were out of the garden, meaning God brought judgment on Adam and Eve. He put them in a world, instead of a perfect world that worked perfectly, he put them in a world where things no longer worked perfectly, where there was conflict and misunderstanding and miscommunications and drama. Now, that's not a pleasant world to live in. But from God's point of view, that's the redemptive way to deal with the sin nature that lies within us. It's almost like God says, I'm going to put you in a world where you are going to have to face the ugliest things about you and deal with it. The fallen world is the perfect place for that. But not only was that judgment a part of it, but fallen people that we have to relate to. And that annoying kind of, why can't we get along kind of thing? It's the perfect material out of which to find what is wrong with me, what else needs changing. And you and I get to live in that same world, fallen world, oh yippee, with fallen people. So here's some of the big pictures I need. Now, Romans 8:28, one of the most famous verses. We know in all things God works for the good of those who love him, who have been called according to his purpose. Now, that word good needs some definition. Sometimes he brings about a good outcome we want. There's a good outcome over here on second thing pleasures we hope for, and sometimes he brings about good over here. But that's not really the central idea of here. The central idea of the good he's trying to do is the refabrication of us and our nature. That's the good he's trying to do, is to take us from second place pleasures to first workplace pleasures. That's what he's trying to do through good. And my shorthand for this is, my God is a redemptive God, and he can redeem anything to change me. For those God foreknew, he also predestined to be conformed to the image of his Son, in order that he might be the firstborn among many brethren. Those he predestined, he called. Those he called, he justified. Those he justified, he also glorified. And I take that to be, as long as I'm alive, that process is going on in me and will continue until I die. It won't be finished then. But shortly after the last breath I take, then the process will be done. I can go to the bank on that. I think about this a lot when difficulties happen that are self-inflicted by me or by other people. My God is redeeming me. Verse 22, we know that the whole creation has been groaning as in the pains of childbirth right up to the present time. Now, when Paul says the whole creation, sometimes theologians say, oh, yeah, well, that's earthquakes and storms and volcanoes and stuff like that. I think, well, those illustrate what he's talking about. But the groaning that he's talking about is the groaning that you and I make. The groaning that happens when I'm not the man that I'm living out how I really should live with my wife or my adult kids or somebody in our church. That's worth groaning over. Or when somebody relates to me in a way that I really it's not that they were mean, but just thoughtless. Then there's a legitimate sadness, a godly sadness, or disappointment. That's inevitable. That's realistic. That's part of what groaning is. It's I see what could be, and it just didn't happen. It just is not happening the way I think. Paul says this is normative, one of the words we've used this week. Groaning is normative. We have reasons to groan while we're in this world. That is not an ungodly thing. We who have the first fruits of the Spirit groan inwardly as we wait eagerly. And here, the idea is the idea of hope. While we're groaning, we are hoping for something in the future that may happen, and it may be some outcome here, or it may not be here. But in the future, on the other side of glory, we can be sure we have a certain hope, an anchored hope that our redemptive God is going to deal with these things. Now, the most encouraging thing to me about this is the little word as. We groan inwardly as we wait eagerly. In other words, he's saying these are godly things of how we should approach difficulties and sad things in life. Both of these are a part of our arsenal in helping us understand the difficulties of life, the difficulties I have with dealing with me, the difficulties of relationship. What does he say we wait eagerly for? Our adoption to sonship. Well, wait a minute, I thought we were already adopted at conversion. Well, we were. In the sense of we were adopted, we sort of have the name tag now. We bear the family name, and the family image is being birthed in us. But what he says here is that the adoption will finally be complete someday. The judge will handle the gavel, hit the gavel, and say, you are now in that family. There's something final about that that's coming. When I think about this, I remember seeing a video a few years ago of a 12-year-old girl who had been in 11 different foster homes. And the last home that she had been in was by far the best. She'd been there about a year. She loved living in that home. It was her first experience of a real father and a real mother and watching this marriage. And the father and mother loved that girl, and they went to court to try to adopt her. And they had to go through, you know, some of the normal legal wranglings that happened. But there's a video of them walking back in the front door of announcing this to that 12-year-old girl. And she is both jumping up and down and sobbing at the same time. And she runs over and gives them a hug. Now, that image, you have that image in your head? That's the kind of thing Paul's talking about here. She had already, in a way, been adopted into their family relationally. But there came a time when it was now official. And that was worth waiting for. That's what he says here. Now, back to my illustration of Kim breaking up with me before my senior year. I drove home in the darkness, an eight-month-old Christian, just my head spinning and shattered dream and lost love. And I walked up to my apartment. It was about midnight by the time I got up and home. And I opened my Bible. And I was still a pretty young student in the Bible. My favorite page in the Bible was the table of contents, you know, page Roman numeral IV, you know, where are these different books of the Bible? And I thought, naively, I need comfort. I think I'll start with Romans. If you're looking for comfort, it's going to be a while before you get to that part of Romans. I read through Romans 1, no comfort. I read through Romans 2, no comfort. I read through Romans 3, and I thought, this story's getting worse. I'm getting depressed reading Romans. I read Romans 4, and Romans 4 was very confusing to me. And when I finally got to Romans 5, some of you that know this, you're way ahead of me. I read verses 3 through 5. Rejoice in your trials that you go through, because your trials produce endurance. Endurance produces character. Character produces what? Hope. Hope. And there was something about that word where I was thinking of a radio guy that said, ding, 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 thanks for calling, hang up, we're home. Hope. Hope does not disappoint us because God's love has been poured into our hearts through the Holy Spirit who has been given to us. Hope is what I needed. Romans 5, 3 through 5, Hebrews 11, 28, since we are receiving a kingdom that cannot be shaken. Interesting word he uses, shaken, there. He's talking about another world to come that can't be shaken. And tacitly what he's saying is, in contrast to this world in which your world can be shaken, like mine was when my girlfriend I thought I was going to marry broke up with me. Dreams shatter. Love is lost. Things don't turn out like they often think they should. And so we worship God acceptably with reverence and awe. Like knowing the way this world works, and as screwed up as it is sometimes, and as screwed up as I am sometimes, and the people around me are, how is it possible that there is another world free of all this drama? Is that possible? And I'm thinking, I think only God could do that. And that's what the writer of Hebrews says. And so we worship God acceptably with reverence, like, oh my gosh, I can't imagine how you would do that. And awe, for our God is a consuming fire. And consuming fire, I think the main imagery there is that wherever there's been injustice, wherever there's been wrong done, ever abuse, son, sin, once that fire is lit, all that stuff is going up in smoke. It's a statement of God's redemptive work, his justice. One of the things I need the big picture on is spiritual maturity. This is on the inside of your outline. I started out as a young 20-something with a very naive view of what spiritual maturity was. And it involved several pieces like this. I thought that what I really needed the most was Bible knowledge. And once I had that knowledge in my grip, then everything would just be great. And then I realized, well, that didn't seem to really be doing enough. And then I thought, okay, I've got to apply the Bible knowledge that I'm getting. And I realized that really wasn't helping me all that much. I think there were several assumptions about this. The assumption that spiritual growth is sort of like this slow, steady incline in which you can see as you look back the progress you've made. And I thought, that's not how it seems to me. It seems to me like my progress is up and down, like a very hilly terrain. And sometimes I don't know if I'm really moving forward or if I'm going backwards. I assumed that life was going to get somewhat easier the older I got and the more spiritually mature I was. And that certainly has not happened. And then the word should was an amazing a point of discouragement for me. I should be farther than this. I should know about this. Why do I keep doing this? I should be, it's kind of beyond that. And all of those things set me up for a massive amount of extra discouragement. It's like I was my own force multiplier of discouragement. There's enough discouragement just living in this world and living with me and living with other people. But I was kind of like this force multiplier so that whenever I didn't meet up to these standards, my near jerk, what's wrong with me? When am I going to get this right? I could not see, because of those metrics, what God was doing to build in me. And so I've got some things in your handout that this is not a full list, but these are just the things that struck me as I look back over my life. What is spiritual maturity? Someone who is learning to love people when loving people is tough. And the image I have in my head of this, of what God is trying to build into my life, is Jesus hanging on a cross. What does it mean to love people with nails in your hands? There are times when it feels like that. And you've got every reason in the world to fight back and to give somebody a piece of your mind. And we're called to the pitcher to do something different. There's spiritual maturity there. The next one, someone who is grateful for evidence of spiritual formation while at the same time broken over the still strong power of their own human nature. In other words, these things can coexist at the same time. One of the things I never saw coming when I was younger was the older I got as a Christian, the more of a mess I was going to see in my heart. It's unbelievable that God loves somebody like me. How is it that you would love somebody with the mechanics, with everything I know, everything I've studied, what I've done, that these mechanics are still humming along rebelliously during the different parts of my day seeking second thing? But I'm not moved over that. I'm not, there's moments of brokenness, but at the same time, it's not a time to sulk. C, instead of despair over a greater awareness of my fallen nature, spiritual maturity generates a sense of wonder. A sense of wonder. How is it, God, that you love somebody like me? After what I did yesterday, or some of the things I did last week. How is it? Now, it's not a question to be answered. It's a question to enter into as a sense of wonder. What kind of love is it that would take somebody and want me to be with you? Fourth, evidence of a longing for God more than an experience of God. In my opinion, and I think plenty of verses show this, what we clamor for is the experience of God. And what God is trying to do is, I can almost sometimes hear God say, oh, no. No, I want you to walk by faith, not by your feelings. I want you to walk by the convictions of Scripture and the promises of God, not by your feelings. I want you to step out with people even when you don't feel like it. There's character that's being built in this maturity, evidence of longing for God. Fifth, people who are open, realistic, and humble about themselves without living in the mud hole of discouragement. Sixth, people who keep on enduring and following Jesus on the narrow road no matter how difficult. The first 7 years we started our church, for 7 years other than five Sundays, when everybody left, I would walk out to my car and sit on the car, hood of the car, and have a conversation with God, something like this. God, I just don't think I have what it takes to do this. It seems like we're trying to build a plane, and I don't think this plane's ever going to fly. I know you led us here. I'm certain of that. But this is way harder than I imagined. Other than five Sundays every week, that's what was going on in that car after everybody left. Endurance was needed here. A growing sense that lost people matter to God and make themselves available to be used by God. This is what David talked to us. There's another element of hope here that was very confusing to me when I first became a Christian. What's all this hoopla about the second coming? You guys probably remember this back in the 80s and 70s. And there were prophecy seminars going all over the country and books written about this, about the second coming. And the big thing that seemed to be in the air all the time was trying to figure out, when is he coming back? And how do the prophecies, Daniel and Ezekiel and Revelation, how do they line up? And then how is this going to happen? When and how is this going to happen? And everybody had their opinion. Are you an amillennialist? Are you a premillennialist? Are you a postmillennialist? Are you a pre-trib rapture? Are you a post-trib rapture? And I remember sort of thinking, all I really am certain about is that Jesus is coming back. And when he does, I'll be glad he does. I'm ready for that. But all this other stuff, it seemed to me after a while, I thought, I think this really misses the point. And then you try to read the book of Revelation, and after you get through chapter 3, good luck. What in the world is John talking about? And we take our Western eyes and we try to map this out and picture this in our head and what's he saying. And it's impossible to do that. And it's not the point either. This is allegorical writing. Allegorical writing is not meant to touch the logical, reasoned part of ourselves. It's meant to attach to the emotional, imagination of our hearts. I think of the images we have of heaven are like clouds and harps and streets of gold. These are not literal what heaven's going to be like. We are meant to take these and extrapolate upwards. They suggest something, each of these, far beyond our ability to comprehend. There's more a sense of wonder here than we can comprehend. And the best that the writers can do for us is to, where we are in our finiteness, give us images that suggest something greater than this. And so with those glasses on, we're going to read some of these passages. Revelation 20, verse 7. When the 1,000 years are over, Satan will be released from his prison and will go out to deceive the nations in the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog, and to gather them for battle. In number, they are like the sand on the seashore. They marched across the breadth of the earth and surrounded the camp of God's people, the city he loves. But fire came down from heaven and devoured them. And the devil who deceived them was thrown into the lake of burning sulfur where the beast and the false prophet had been thrown. They will be tormented day and night forever and ever. This is allegorical language. It's exaggerated language to make some points. If you try to sit down and map out Gog and Magog and how many people there were here and how does the fire come down, you're not going to understand this. So here are a few things in your handout that strike me from this. It is a very strong statement that ultimate judgment is coming. You can go to the bank on that. It's hard to imagine a firmer way of saying this than with this imagery that we just read. No matter how powerful evil is, there is the ultimate doom of evil. That should evoke a sense of wonder in us. A rebellious world will finally come to an end. And won't that be glorious? It's hard to imagine. Verse 11. I saw a great white throne and him who was seated on it. The earth and the heavens fled from his presence, and there was no place for them. I saw the dead, great and small, standing before the throne. Books were opened. Another book was opened, which is the book of life. The dead were judged according to what they had done, as recorded in the books. The sea gave up the dead that were in it, and death and Hades gave up the dead that were in them, and each person was judged according to what they had done. Then death and Hades were thrown into the lake of fire. The lake of fire is the second death. Anyone whose name was not found written in the book of life was thrown into the lake of fire. Now, these are just some of the big picture things that strike me as I imagine what John is trying to convey to us. A righteous reckoning will take place and people will get exactly what they deserve. Pure justice. Second, justice will prevail. Evil will be ultimately and fully defeated, and God will be judged. Now, this next section strikes me with the theme of eternal joy. And when I think of joy, I think of two kinds of joy. I'm going to call the first one joy number one. The second one, joy number two. Isn't that just so creative? Joy number one and joy number two. Joy number one is the kind of joy we all want. I want to feel joyful right now. And there are times where we do feel joyful, and I'm happy about that, and so are you. But that is not our normal, everyday experience. When it happens, it's really good. But there's a second kind of joy, joy number two, that could be a daily experience. And it's offered to us. Let's look at this, Genesis 21:1. I saw a new heaven and a new earth. The first heaven and first earth had passed away, and there was no longer any sea. I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride, beautifully dressed for her husband. Again, allegorical language. Extrapolate upward. Let your imagination go here. I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, "Look, God's dwelling place is now among the people, and he will dwell with them, and they will be his people, and God himself will be them, and their God. He will wipe every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death, or mourning, or crying, or pain, for the old order of things has passed away." He who was seated on the throne said, "I am making everything." Now, what that's supposed to evoke in us is the anticipation of a second kind of joy that will last eternally. And this is a strange kind of joy because I don't hold it in my hand right now. I can't clench onto that. I can't make that joy happen. But joy number two is the anticipation of joy. And that is offered to us every day through verses like this. When I think about the anticipation of joy, I can't help but think about my mother. When we were growing up, whenever Christmas time, as soon as Thanksgiving was over, Thanksgiving decorations were put away, and Christmas began. Christmas decorations were put up. I remember these little electric candles that she would put in the front windows of the house, and if you were driving at our house up at night, it sort of put this warm glow across the front of our house. She had two Christmas albums that played every night, and it was like magic filled the air. The aura, the sense of Christmas. Christmas is coming. Christmas is coming. She would have us start counting down. How many days till Christmas? 21 days till Christmas, we'd tell Mom. There was the day when we went out with Dad to get the Christmas tree. Brought in the Christmas tree, and we laughed as he was trying to, we shouldn't have laughed, but we laughed as he was trying to put it in the stand. And then the lights went up. Christmas is coming. Christmas is coming. And he would get all those lights up and plug them in. And I can still remember some of those lights were blinking and some of them just stayed on. Red, yellow, blue, and green. And it was just something magical that just said, Christmas is coming. And my mother would bake Christmas cookies and Christmas candy and Christmas fudge. The aroma of Christmas was filling the house. And there were presents that were coming in from relatives. And my mother would open the boxes of those, and if they weren't wrapped, she wrapped them and put them under the tree. And there was this growing sense of boxes that said, Christmas is coming. It's getting closer. And I will tell you, as a kid, every day, the anticipation of joy got greater and greater and greater. She had a little Advent thing, and some of you probably have seen this. Maybe you had this in your home where every day you pop up this little tab and, you know, today's the manger and over here's the angel and here's baby Jesus and here's the sheep. But all of this together, she was a master at creating the anticipation of what was coming. Now, I look back on those days now, and I think there was more joy collectively in the anticipation of Christmas than even Christmas Day. Now, in my opinion, that picture is how we're supposed to live with eternity in view and the kind of eternity our redemptive God is going to present to us. That's what these verses are for, in my opinion. We extrapolate upward, and there should be a sense of wonder about what's coming and the joy of anticipation. He said to me, "It is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. To the thirsty, I will give water without cost from the spring of water of life. Those who are victorious will inherit all this. I will be their God. They will be my children." Again, a sense of wonder and the joy of anticipation is woven into these verses. Verse 9, "Come, I will show you the bride, the wife of the Lamb. He carried me away, the Spirit, to a mountain great and high. He showed me the holy city, Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven." You can read the rest of these on your own. All of these have to do with a sense of wonder and the joy of anticipation. All of this says to me, what anchors us in God's larger story? It's the different things we've looked at this week. And I will tell you personally, these are the five things I thought of most that have anchored me for the long haul when life gets tough. There are other things like scripture memory and quiet time. I'm a quiet time guy, scripture memory guy, fellowship guy, discipleship guy. All that's been hugely helpful to me. But in terms of walking with God through really difficult times, it's the stuff we've talked about this week. David and Marianne, would you come up here for a moment? So our thing is the golden dove. And I would like to give this to you as just sort of a memento of our week today. I wish this was bigger so you all could see it. But it's two doves. And a gold heart, and it looks like a little clear heart. Mm-hmm. And the central idea of this is not marriage directly. It's two people who are trying to seek first thing pleasures in their life, looking at each other. So this is your remembrance for the week. Thanks, you guys can... is it okay if we run a little long? Okay. I guess I kind of put you on the spot. What else could you say? So I have a story. I want to give something to you all. And we've got a delightful video to finish tonight with, as far as my part. There was a woman in a church, elderly woman. She had terminal cancer. She had about 3 months to live. And she called the pastor and came over, and she wanted to plan the service with him. Talked about music, scripture reading, message, all these kinds of things. And she got everything out there. And just about the time he was leaving, she remembered something. She said, "Pastor, come back here." And it was going to be an open casket viewing and ceremony. Said, "When they put me in that casket for the viewing and the ceremony, would you put a fork in my hand?" I said, "A fork? Why do you want a fork in your hand?" She said, "Because what struck me was, in all the different fellowship meetings we've been, and all the potlucks, whenever it's time to clean everything up and dessert's coming, what we always hear is, keep your fork." And what she associated that with was, the best is yet to come. The dessert. So we do have our golden dove up here, but we also have something else for all of you. The golden forks. Hey, David, we do have camp insurance, don't we? Oh my God. You boys better keep your hat on. All right, where have we not? Who doesn't have a fork yet? The front row. Oh my gosh. Joshua. All right, I saw some hands over here. All right, the front row. All right, anybody else? We missing a fork. Back row. You all might want to run for cover, but I see physics at work here with acceleration. All right, if I missed anybody, you can come up. We got lots of forks. Last video we're going to watch is from Narnia. And it's that great part where Peter... And how many of you are familiar with Narnia? Okay, quite a few. Okay, there are four kids, Peter and Edmund, two boys, Susan and Lucy. The oldest are probably older teenagers. The two others are probably right at the cusp of younger teenagers. And they've been called to Narnia by Aslan the lion, who's God. And he uses these kids' lives to bring redemption to some awful situations. And finally... it comes to the end where they are finally taken home. And it is an exquisite scene. Now, C.S. Lewis used his imagination. I'm not saying that this is what's going to happen, but it wouldn't surprise me if it was something like this. And you're going to see what happens with these four. And then we have spliced together a second scene afterwards that is not in the movie. Well, I'll come up and explain in a minute. Can you come up and get this for me? While our folks are finishing, worship team, you guys can come on up. Get ready, and we're going to roll right into worship in just a moment. Got a little more time? A word, a phrase, a concept, a verse. What's a takeaway?